Deir el-Zour. You may not have heard the name of that town in Syria, but there were reports of violence all weekend long. And this morning, we're hearing fresh artillery fire and machine gun fire, live fire into crowds in that city following a bloody weekend, which left dozens killed. Thousands were forced to flee, according to the reports we're getting, as the Syrian regime continues its violent crackdown on protesters. The Saudis joined the condemnation of Syria by withdrawing their ambassador from Damascus. King Abdullah actually issued a statement that was read over Saudi media, calling for an end to the bloodshed there and calls for immediate reforms. For the latest on this, we're joined by Anthony Shadid, bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. Anthony, good morning.
Good morning.
So a lot to sort out. Begin with the King Abdullah Saudi story and any suspicion that it would have an impact in Damascus. And then tell us what you're hearing from the areas of unrest around Syria.
You know, I think we have to keep in mind on Saudi Arabia that, you know, of course, Saudi Arabia is one of the most repressive countries in the Arab world. It dispatched its military forces to Bahrain to quell an uprising there. But it is notable that the Saudis did withdraw their ambassador from Damascus. And I think it in some ways reflects the temperature in the region right now, that an Arab world that has been reluctant to criticize the Syrian government has begun to escalate its criticism. And I think most significantly, it demonstrates the growing isolation of President Bashar al-Assad's regime in Damascus at this point. And I think it points to mounting pressures on that regime that are going to probably manifest themselves in you know, days and weeks ahead.
You know, focusing on the Saudi statement for a moment, here's a couple of quotes. What's happening in Syria is not acceptable to Saudi Arabia. The events are too big for them to be justified. Syrian authorities are capable of implementing comprehensive reforms fast. That doesn't, you know, sound like a human rights sort of motivated statement filled with, you know, democratic values. It's more, you guys are blowing it. Look at us. We did a good job in Yemen and Bahrain. You guys are messing up here.
Well, I'm not sure I'd see it that way, actually. I mean, I think we'd probably want to put it more in the context of Saudi-Syrian relations. And that's a relationship that was long cold, that warmed up, you know, probably in the past 18 months, and that has turned cold again. We have to remember that, you know, the Syrian government is a minority government. It's a minority Alawite government in a country that has a Sunni Muslim majority. There are ties, let's say, between parts of the Syrian opposition and elements of the Saudi leadership. It's a very, I think, peculiar relationship, and it's one that probably should be taken at face value, just the relationship between Saudi Arabia and Syria. I think when you take a step back, we have to remember that Arab governments are very reluctant to criticize each other. I think Libya was the most notable exception when the Arab League in some ways gave cover to NATO's intervention there. But in general, they're very reluctant to criticize each other. And I think the Saudis taking this step, you know, first and foremost shows that that the Syrian government is probably more isolated right now than it's ever been in four decades of the family's rule.
We're talking with Anthony Shadid, Beirut bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. Anthony, I'm looking at a map now. Last week, it was all about Hama and the unrest that was taking place there and the difficulty of getting reports out of that city. This morning, our listeners are hearing about Deir el-Zour and the unrest going on there. Can you contrast and describe the different communities, the different cities, and what's the significance of what's taking place in Deir el-Zour?
You know, I think we have to remember that Deir el-Zour is a city populated by extended clans that have ties to other groups in eastern Syria and even western Iraq and in Anbar province. And of course, remember Anbar during the insurgency was one of the most violent arenas in the insurgency that was waged against the American occupation there. Its people are armed. They're well armed. They have deep-seated grievances, everything from government neglect to not sharing in the wealth of the oil and gas that you find in that region. To be honest, a lot of people thought that Deir el-Zour was untouchable, that the government wasn't going to risk a fight with these extended clans because it could go bad very quickly. It has, in fact, risked that fight. It's intervened. The reports that we understand, there are hundreds of tanks and armored personnel carriers that are on the outskirts and making forays into the town. That fight has started. And I think when you talk to people, especially analysts who seem to have a pretty good grounding on Syria, it seems more and more that the government is picking a fight with more people than it can handle. Deir el-Zour, of course, is one. Hama, another city that suffered a brutal crackdown in 1982, and given that bloodshed, many people thought he was off limits. the army entered Hama as well 8 days ago. So I think we're seeing the government resorting to what it sees as its only card at this point, and that is violent crackdown.
Anthony Shadid, Beirut Bureau Chief for our partner, The New York Times, and you make a really interesting point contrasting Hama's population with the well-armed and clan-oriented and really easily radicalized population in Deir al-Zour. But I guess it demands this question, and that is why have Aleppo and Damascus, the two largest cities in Syria, been curiously immune from this kind of violence?
Well, I think Aleppo is perplexing to everyone. Why hasn't Aleppo risen? Of course, we have seen, you know, I don't want to say it's reached a critical mass by any points, but by any means, but I think we have seen some growing protests in Aleppo. Aleppo, of course, was an arena for contest against the government back in the late 70s and early 80s, and there may be a sense in Aleppo that it doesn't want to risk it until the tide has absolutely turned, until we see, you know, a decisive moment having perhaps passed. Damascus is easier to understand, I think, in some respects, given just the intensive security presence that you have there. It's the capital, therefore it's the prestige, you know, it's a mark of prestige for the regime. And for the government to lose Damascus, I think things would fall apart very quickly. So given the security presence there, I think you can understand Damascus staying somewhat quiet. You know, a lot of people make the remark that if there wasn't security in Damascus, you'd probably have 100,000 people in the streets the next day. Those two cities are very important to keep an eye on as this goes forward, because as Damascus and Aleppo go, so goes the regime's fate.
Finally, before we go, is the reporting assignment getting easier? Are you able to find more credible sources of information in these various cities that are having all of these difficult problems on the streets?
You know, I think it's one of the toughest stories a lot of us have ever reported, because it is difficult to get. It's not difficult to reach people. That's pretty easy, but it's sometimes difficult to get what you feel is an authoritative account of what's going on.
Trying to confirm the violent details that are coming out of Syria this morning from Deir al-Zour in that country where there is unrest and reports of fatalities on the streets. Anthony Shadid watching the situation from Beirut. He's Beirut Bureau Chief for our partner, The New York Times. As always, thank you, Anthony.
My pleasure. Anytime.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.